Okay, we are talking about how to do exegesis, that is, draw the meaning from biblical text, and we have been covering the ground of first things first, submitting the mind and the heart to God, choosing a passage, establishing the text, that is, coming to some determination as to what the original text must have been, and so far as we're able to do that. And then we began talking about reading the text literarily, first looking at general features of narrative, looking for plot and characterization and point of view and that kind of thing. And then secondly, looking for special literary devices that are particularly characteristic of Old Testament narrative, and to some extent also of New Testament narrative, but of biblical narrative. I've only been able to allude to some of these. Let me just maybe mention a couple of others. The main things I mentioned were scenic, succinct, and subtle narrative. The Bible is scenic in its depiction. It sets itself out as scenes of a play. It's succinct. It says things in a few short words. And it communicates its messages sometimes quite boldly and explicitly, but sometimes subtly and implicitly, and we need to be alerted to those. And so we look for clues in the text. What are weighted words and phrases? And when last we were speaking, we talked about one of the ways in which a biblical narrator can add weight to a particular word or phrase or verse is to elevate the diction, turn from prose into poetry. And just to kind of recap that, or to say another word about it, often if you're listening to a good sermon, you will notice that at a certain point in the sermon, the preacher may begin to wax eloquent. And what he has to say some sermons never wax eloquent, but most do. I have a high regard for my brothers who preach week by week. But at certain points, when the preacher wants to drive home his proposition or the main thing he wants you to get, he's probably spent some time, if he's a good preacher and a good sermon, he's probably spent some time crafting just how he wants to say that thing. And it often will ring in our ears almost as if it's poetry. And so we do the same thing. You know, if it's especially important, elevate the diction. Say it in a carefully crafted way. Well, the same thing happens in biblical text. So be careful when you run into poetry in the midst of prose. And a commentary tells you that that's therefore secondary because of the change in style. You say, no, it may be doubly important because of the change in style. Now, another way that a particular line or phrase or word may be emphasized is simply through repetition. Now, we're not keen on repetition too much. We get bored by it and we think it's redundant. But in biblical narrative, which, though written, was written to be read and heard, we sometimes have repetition to draw our attention back to something that's already been said, much in the same way that a film will sometimes have a flashback. It'll replay a scene. Now, if you were working a video recorder and could just run it backwards, then it might just have a directive there, run back to such and such a place. Or if you're reading a book, flip back to such and such a page. But that's not the way the biblical texts were written. And so often we'll have repetition that is meant to recall something that happened earlier and draw our mind back to that. It's kind of a flashback. Other times we have simple repetition of more or less the same thing being said by several characters or by the narrator, and we're meant to listen to how each character says this thing and to compare and to contrast what is being said. Sometimes the examples are very, very obvious. In 1 Samuel 15, God appears to Samuel, or at least communicates to Samuel, that Saul has not carried out his instructions. Samuel goes off to meet Saul, and when he meets him, Saul says, "I have carried out the Lord's instructions." Obviously, we have a difference of opinion here, and the question is, whose opinion counts? Obviously, God has a different assessment of what Saul has been doing. That's a very simple example, but there are many, many examples of repetition where you want to watch for the very, sometimes very subtle variation that may nevertheless carry quite a freight of meaning. Robert Alter, in his very interesting and provocative book called The Art of Biblical Narrative, The Art of Biblical Narrative, from which I stole the title of my book, The Art of Biblical History. His book sold exceptionally well, and so I thought, well, I'll at least steal most of his title. No, I did it for a purpose because I think that we can learn a lot about history writing by understanding narrative writing. But anyway, if it helps sales, all the better. But anyway, he develops some of these ideas and describes the function of repetition and the function of repetition with variation. And we want to be watching for that kind of thing. Also, insofar as we can catch it, we want to be looking for wordplay. That's another way in which attention is drawn to a particular word or two. And thus, weight is added to those particular words. Also, when we have intertextual allusions, when one text alludes to another text, that may be suggestive of a particularly significant phrase. One that let me mention one to you that's sort of in my mind. I don't know if this is going to pan out or not, but it's something that I noticed a while back, and it intrigues me. Look at Joshua chapter 10. I probably shouldn't let this kind of thing get on tape since I'm not at all sure of this one. But look at Joshua chapter 10, verse 21. Now, I need to set the context for you a little bit because, again, the context is very important for understanding what a particular portion within that text means. This is the story of the defense of the city of Gibeon by Joshua. Now, if you've read, many of you are already reading Joshua. You should read it by next week and have it done. But remember, chapter 9 recounted the Gibeonite deception, where these citizens of Gibeon came out and they had dressed themselves up in such a way that they looked like they had been journeying for some time. They brought dry, crusty bread and worn-out sandals. And they managed to convince the Israelites that they were indeed from a far country. And we read in verse 14 that the men of Israel sampled their provisions, but did not inquire of the Lord. There's the crucial mistake that they made. And they were duped by the Gibeonites, and they made a covenant with them, even though the Gibeonites were Canaanites. They lived in the land of Canaan, and the order was drive out the Canaanites, because if they remain in your midst, they will become thorns in your sides. They will test you. They will possibly bring you down, and they were to be driven out. The iniquity of the Canaanites was full. We will have occasion to talk about that very thorny, no pun intended, that very thorny issue later in one of the debating points, the genocide of the Canaanites. But that's the background. And a covenant has been made between Israel and Gibeon. Gibeon suddenly finds itself in danger, in military danger, and the Israelites have to go out not to drive out a Canaanite city, but to defend a Canaanite city, of all things. And they do so successfully. And in verse 20, they destroyed those completely who had been attacking the Gibeonites, almost to a man, but the few who were left reached their fortified cities. And then in verse 21, it says, "The whole army then returned safely to Joshua in the camp at Makkedah, and no one uttered a word against the Israelites." Now, because I understood that biblical narrative tends to be very succinct, not to add extraneous details, to be very economic in its use of words, I wondered to myself what the significance of this little notice that no one uttered a word against the Israelites might be. And so I began to do a kind of a concordance search to see if that phrase occurred elsewhere. And it's translated quite differently in Exodus 11:7, but the very same word, the very same construction occurs there. And it's the only other time it occurs in the Hebrew Bible. So, again, I'm saying I'm very tentative about this, but it intrigues me as a kind of a little detail that may bear a freight of meaning. Look back at Exodus chapter 11, verse 7. Maybe someday I'll try to work this out, and if it really stands up, maybe I'll write a little note on this, a little textual note for a journal somewhere. In Exodus chapter 11, verse 7, this is at the end of the account of the plagues that came upon Egypt. And it says in verse 7, "But among the Israelites, not a dog will bark at any man or animal." Now, that, believe it or not, that is the phrase. No one uttered a word. The same phrase is used here and translated, "not a dog will bark." Now, dog is different, but the notion of barking is the same. Literally, in Hebrew, it says, "No one sharpened a tongue against..." No one spoke, in other words, with sharp tongue. Likewise here, not a dog sharpened a tongue or barked at any of the Israelites, at any man or animal. And notice that then the comment is made, then you will know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. Now, I wonder if there's not a rather sophisticated allusion, an ironic allusion, in the history in Joshua to pick up on that detail, which I'm not saying it didn't happen, but to pick that particular detail and to describe it in such a way that those aware of Israel's antecedent history would think back and say, that's an unusual way to say, oh, I heard that before. That's in the plague account. In that verse that says, and then you will know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. And here, because we didn't pray, we didn't inquire, we're in the promised land and we're already blurring that distinction. We're out fighting battles, not driving out the Canaanites, but defending Canaanites. Now, you may not buy that. I may not buy that over time. But it's the kind of thing that we need to be alerted to. Sometimes those things are in the text. This may be a possibility. If anyone can help me with further supporting evidence, I would be happy. Or if it's completely lame, tell me later. Don't tell me on tape. Okay. So in various different ways, the biblical narratives are distinctive in some of the narrative techniques and narrative devices that they use. Repetition, wordplay, intertextual allusion, elevated diction. All of these kinds of things we want to be aware of and looking for. Now, moving on to the next issue, in terms of reading the text literarily, we want to look for significant words and phrases. This is what we would call lexical and grammatical analysis. Words that are repeated or for some reason appear to be significant, you want to highlight in your mind. And you may want to do a word study. You can do a word study by consulting a Bible dictionary or by consulting a concordance and seeing where else that word occurs. What is its significance in those other contexts? And that can enrich your understanding of a word in this particular context. So look for significant words and phrases. Now, you might say, well, how do I know if it's significant? Well, there's no easy answer. Exegesis is both an art and a science. You know, there are certain principles that we apply, but there's a lot of intuition involved. So the better trained you become in spotting things, the better will be your intuitions. And you'll say, I wonder if that's significant. Then you pursue it and discover, yeah, this is a key word. Now, if a word recurs in a given context, it might be what Martin Buber described as a Leitwort, a leading word. That's German, Leitwort, a leading word or a key word. It's simply by virtue of its recurrence that may bring to mind that, oh, this is one I should study. This is what this text is about. It carries some kind of thematic significance. I'm going to move quickly through some of these. The next thing is to look for structure. Many of you may be aware of current trends in literary study, the trend called structuralism. I'm not particularly talking about structuralism. I'm really talking about structural analysis, something as simple as looking for the outline of a particular passage. How does the discourse progress? So it may be more akin to discourse analysis than structuralism as defined by literary criticism. To give you an example of how structure, I think, can be important, at the very beginning of 1 Samuel, you have the introduction in chapter 1 of Hannah and her problem being childlessness and the provocation she was getting from Peninnah because Peninnah had children, Hannah had none, as we were mentioning earlier. But then as you go on, you have a description of how God heard Hannah's prayer, gave her Samuel as a son. She dedicated him to the Lord. Eli has appeared already in chapter 1. Then as you get into chapter 2, suddenly the focus shifts in verse 12 off of Samuel, Hannah, and then her son Samuel, and to the sons of Eli. Eli's sons were wicked men in verse 12 of chapter 2. They had no regard for the Lord, or some translations say they did not know the Lord. Well, then the focus stays on the abuses of Eli's sons for a while until we come to verse 17, which kind of sums it up. The sins of the young men was very great in the Lord's sight, for they were treating the Lord's offering with contempt. Verse 18, but Samuel. Okay, now Samuel's back in the picture. But Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a young man wearing a linen ephod. Again, the same word is used for the young men, Eli's sons, and the young man, Samuel. NIV translates once with boy, but it's the same word. And so there's a comparison and a contrast being established between Eli's sons, who are wicked, and Samuel, who is serving before the Lord. And that the focus stays on Samuel until verse 21, and then in verse 22, it goes back to Eli. Now, Eli was very old and heard about everything his sons were doing to all Israel. Has to hear. He's not really being terribly observant in his dim-sighted state. He's also not very observant of what his sons are about. And the focus continues to be on Eli. He goes and rebukes his sons, and it says at the end of that little paragraph that his sons, however, did not listen to him, did not listen to their father's rebuke, for it was the Lord's will to put them to death. A little bit of heavy theology there. Something about the sovereignty of God and His right of control over His creatures. They didn't listen because it pleased God to put them to death. In other words, sometimes God visits repetitive, unrepentant sin with an inability to do otherwise. Sometimes God visits, punishes sin with sin. The notion of I'll wait and be converted on my deathbed is a very risky proposition because God softens our hearts and opens our eyes. And by then, they may well be well closed. But anyway, the focus has stayed on Eli's sons. But then we're back to Samuel in verse 26. And the boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and in favor with the Lord and with men. Then we're back to Eli, verse 27, and so forth and so on. It goes back and forth, back and forth. Now, this is a structural aspect of the text that lets us know that the narrator is intending to develop a contrast between Eli and his sons, and why it is that God rejects them, and what it is that God is looking for in His servants, in this case, in Samuel. So just by noticing the way these are interwoven, we learn something about the message of the text. It gives us some insight into it. So it's very important, as you're studying a text, to outline it. Now, you're doing outlines of books, and that's great because you get the overview of the book. Now, as you go to study individual chapters, which I'm not going to ask you to do extensive outlines of each chapter, but as you study a chapter, you'll want also to outline that chapter, and that will help you see what the structure is, what the discourse is. Another thing that you want to look for is special forms. Special forms. This is what we refer to as form criticism. Form criticism has something of a bad reputation, and for good reason, because form criticism is sometimes abusive of biblical texts. In fact, James Meilenberg, in a presidential address to the Society of Biblical Literature back in, I think, 1971, gave a lecture or a presidential address in which was entitled Beyond Form Criticism. He said the problem with form criticism is that we get in mind these kind of ideal forms that biblical literature is supposed to display or exhibit. And then we look at the Bible itself and we discover that, well, yeah, the ideal form may be reflected in this text, but the text is also more particular than that. Maybe it bends the form. Maybe it goes beyond it. And he said, the problem with form criticism is often it begins to monkey with the text to make the text fit the general form. It's sort of like if your pastor preaches a four-point sermon and you insist that sermons should have 3 points in a poem, you know, and so you say, the fourth point can't count. You can't do that. You're breaking form. Well, the pastor says, no, I know what the ideal form is, what the normal common form is. I wanted to have a fourth point. I wanted to keep you till 1:30 this afternoon. So, likewise with the biblical narrators, I think they had a sense of expectations, you know, what kind of elements would be in a particular form of literature, but they felt free to expand, to go beyond. And James Meilenberg says, we need to look at the particularity and not simply force text to conform to some ideal notion of what the particular structure of a text could be. Again, an example in the story of Eli, right where we were, beginning in chapter 2, verse 27, we have what is called a prophetic judgment speech. Now, that's a formal description, a prophetic judgment speech. And if you've ever had to chastise one of your offspring, which I doubt that any of you have ever had to do, or if you've ever been chastised as the offspring of someone else, it's quite logical the form that a judgment speech takes. The two major components are accusation and announcement of judgment. I've heard it once, I've heard it 1,000 times from my dad. I had a 12 o'clock curfew when I was a teenager, and I would come in at 12:10, you know, kind of thumping my watch as if he was really stupid. I didn't know, Dad. Must be something wrong with my watch. He would say, why were you late? You know, you're supposed to be home at 12, 12:10, 12:15. Why were you late? Why didn't you call? Now, he wasn't actually asking for information. That was an accusation. Those are what we call accusing questions. And very often in the Bible, the question is, what have you done? Or why have you done that? Often a prophetic judgment speech begins with some description of the benevolence of God to His people. In the case of Eli, God begins by saying, did I not clearly reveal myself to your father's house when they were in Egypt under Pharaoh? I chose your father to be priest, etc., etc. God has been good to Eli. I also gave your father's house all the offerings made with fire by the Israelites. Verse 29, why do you scorn my sacrifice and offering that I prescribed for my dwelling? You know, my father says, look, we've given you a reasonable curfew. 12 o'clock is pretty good, particularly from a father who doesn't believe that anything good ever happened after 10 o'clock at night. He once told me that, you know, that really, at least among teenagers, nothing good really ever happens after 10 o'clock at night. But he would give us till 12. You know, we've been generous. This is reasonable. So why are you late? Okay, well, the same kind of thing happens in a judgment speech. God has been good to you. So why have you done that? And then there comes the announcement of judgment. Because you've done that, or therefore, this is what is going to happen. And in that part of the speech, there's often a what is called a correspondence motif. In other words, here's the offense, here's the judgment. The judgment matches the offense. Later it will be said to Saul, because you've rejected the word of the Lord, so the Lord has rejected you from being king. All to show that it's fair, that it's right, that it's good. Now, that's the basic form of a judgment speech. And it helps us, I think, to understand what is being said to Eli, to have in mind that, yeah, that's typical. That's the way a rebuke and a judgment is often issued. Now, it goes beyond that, however, and helps us a little bit more when we come, say, to chapter 10 of 1 Samuel. And I'm not going to get into this now because you really will need a little more background in it. But let me just say that when you come to chapter 10, beginning in verse 17, we have Samuel gather Israel together to elect a king, or to see whom it is that God will choose. Now, the point is, Samuel has already anointed Saul. He has given Saul a task, and in my view, this is my private view that I'm trying to propagate, but I think it makes good sense, and I'm gradually making headway in doing that. Samuel has given Saul a charge that Saul has hesitated even to embark upon. And Saul has done nothing to distinguish himself, to bring himself to public attention. So Samuel finds it necessary to convene an assembly and to conduct a lot casting, which typically is used to sort out who the criminal is. It'll be used in the book of Joshua to sort out Achan. And there are a lot of verbal parallels even between the sorting out of Achan, the lot casting to discover Achan, and the lot casting here. And many commentators have noted that this begins like a judgment speech. It's like Samuel's mad about something, and it's like Saul is guilty of something, but MacArthur in his commentary says, we don't know what. We don't know what he's guilty of. Well, when we get to talking about Saul, I'll try to explain more what I think he was guilty of and why it does begin like a judgment speech. The accusation is there. And then just at the point where you would have the announcement of judgment, he says, okay, let's cast lots. Lots that will eventually land on Saul. And so in a sense, Saul is given to the people as a judgment. So the reason I go into all of this is I think there is a valid use of form criticism, even though it's something that has been misused by critics in the past and thus is suspect. We need to be careful how we use something like this, but to recognize there may be some validity to it and we can use it in our study so long as we continue to embrace a proper set of presuppositions about the text and such and don't buy into the philosophical underpinnings that sometimes come along with form criticism. The next thing we need to look for, and this is even a little more dodgy perhaps, is we need to look for evidence of composition. How has the text come to be? It's not absolutely necessary to do this, but sometimes we find ourselves dealing with texts that are quite perplexing. We'll later have a chance to look at the Davidic promise as God makes an astonishing promise to King David in 2 Samuel 7. And we will compare that to 1 Chronicles 17. And we will discover that those two events are described in somewhat different ways. And even the words of God to David are described in different ways. And in that instance, it's important for us to realize that the chronicler is well aware of the Samuel text. In other words, it's clear as we read the book of Chronicles that he's making use of source material. He's using Samuel Kings, the history of Samuel Kings, and he alludes also to, or mentions also other sources at his disposal, the writings of Samuel the prophet and Gad, Samuel the seer, Gad the prophet, Iddo the prophet. He mentions other sources that were at his disposal, and he is using these in the writing of his sort of homiletical history of Israel. But he, I believe, was aware, obviously he was aware of his sources, but I think he presupposed that his hearers were aware of his sources. And therefore, when he takes some liberties with the exact wording of 2 Samuel 7, for instance, and in my view, he's drawing out of the shadows what is only implicit in 2 Samuel 7 and is really making it explicit. He is, as it were, putting it in God's mouth, making it explicit. I believe that's acceptable. I mean, it's their phenomena we have to deal with. I believe that's acceptable because he is, we're aware, and he is aware, and his hearers and readers were aware of the other source. So it's not like he was twisting the facts or anything like that. He was drawing out of the shadows something that was implicit in those earlier words and making it a little more explicit to his hearers. We'll have to look at the text in detail for you to feel at all comfortable with that. I know it's a little perplexing notion, but it's there in the text, and so we need to assess it in one way or another. So we look for the way in which sources have been used and the way in which the writer has redacted those sources. Now, I know that's, again, a dangerous kind of thing because redaction criticism has been grossly abused by, unbelieving critics or liberal critics at times. But I'm talking about what we find in the text, a kind of construction of the narrative in order to make the chronicler's point to his audience. Okay, just as a preacher, in a sense, is a redactor of the biblical text because he begins with the biblical text, he reads it, his congregation hears it, and then he begins to elaborate. He begins to tease out the implications of that text. And you might call that redaction. It's in that vein that I mean it, not in some other sense. And then moving on, we need to look for the contextual significance of whatever it is we're reading. We talked about the necessity of reading the broader context. This is where we get into biblical theological analysis, or what is often called canonical analysis, canonical criticism. We want to explore the text's significance in the story of which it is a part. Okay, you want to look more broadly and say, how does this function in the story? In the broader story. Take, for instance, Judges 19. This is that horrific story of the Levite who is from an obscure village in Ephraim, whose concubine leaves him and runs home to father. And the Levite goes south to Bethlehem to regain his concubine. And there the father-in-law engages him in 4 days of hospitality, and hospitality is a good thing, but it's beginning to go on and on. Each day the Levite wants to leave and go home, and the father-in-law cajoles him and says, "Oh, no, please stay another few days. Let's eat and drink again, enjoy yourself, rest over the night, and then go in the morning." Finally, it's into the fifth day, and the Levite says, "We've got to get going." And the father-in-law convinces him still to eat and drink some more, and so it's very late in the day that the Levite is able to finally get moving. And so they're coming from Bethlehem, they're only as far as Jebus, which is Jerusalem, when nightfall begins to encroach upon them. And the Levite's servant says, "Hey, we've got to find lodging. We don't want to be out on the road after dark. Let's go into Jebus." And the Levite says, no, we're not going to go into a Canaanite city. We'll go to an Israelite city. We'll press on as far as Gibeah or perhaps Ramah." And so they get to Gibeah. And they're sitting there in the square, and the men of Gibeah pretty well ignore them, and no one comes to take them in, until finally an old Ephraimite, who is sojourning, comes in from the field, and he sees them there, asks them what they're doing. Levite says he's on his way from Bethlehem back to Ephraim. he's got all his supplies and everything. And the old man from Ephraim says, well, come to my house. You know, I'll put you up. No problem. And that's what they do. And then what happens? Then the men of the town of Gibeah come out, surround the house, and they say, send out that guest you have. You know, we want to know him. Now, that's that biblical word that has a different range of meaning. You know, it can be knowledge of a carnal nature or knowledge of a sexual nature. And that's what they're asking. Well, instead of that, the host says, well, you know, what about my daughter? Take my daughter. And then the Levite says, maybe to save him from doing that, he takes the concubine that he's gone to all this trouble to woo back and is taking home, casts her out to the crowd. And then, you know, they abuse her all night. And in the morning, it says, when the Levite got up and unlocked the door. Now, you know, explain this to me, but that doesn't seem reasonable. You know, he had apparently locked the door and kind of cut his losses and gone to bed. And, you know, it just doesn't seem right. And he finds her on the doorstep and says, let's get up and get going. She doesn't move. It's not absolutely clear whether she's dead or alive at that point, but he loads her on his donkey. And did you know this was in the Bible? And takes her back to his place and divides her into 12 pieces and sends the pieces throughout the land of Israel, and thus provokes an intertribal warfare where the people are aghast at this horrible thing that's happened, and they come out to deal with the tribe of Benjamin and the city of Gibeah, an Israelite city. Now, we need to consider the context, because when I first was reading that story, I kept thinking, how can this be? You know, was the Levite doing the right thing, or is it excusable what the host did or whatever? But then when I began to realize, to read the context, I realized that in those days, Israel had no king. As it says in chapter 17, verse 6, in those days Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. And I don't think it's just saying there's no human king. Certainly that's on the surface. But it's also saying God, during the period of the judges, was not being honored as king. And the place was running wild. Everyone was doing what he thought best, what was good in his own eyes. And what is good in our own eyes is not necessarily good. And that refrain is repeated, 18 verse 1, in those days Israel had no king. 19 1, in those days Israel had no king. And then you come over to chapter 21, right at the end, the very last verse in the book. In those days Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. And finally I began to realize, well, of course everything's out of whack. The hospitality is exorbitant. You know, the father-in-law is doing what he thinks is best, and it's not right. The host is doing what he thinks is best, and it's not right. The Levite is doing what he thinks is best, and it's not right. And even the concubine may have been doing what she thought was best, running home to father. And maybe that wasn't right, because it says she was unfaithful to him. There's a translational difficulty there as well. So we don't know whether she was the innocent party or whether she was complicitous in the thing as well. But by looking at the context, we begin to say, okay, all right, no one was doing what was right. I don't need to find the good guys. The moral of that story is nothing was happening that was right. So when we begin to explore it in the context of the broader story, in the context of the book, it begins to make some sense. It is to characterize the religious degeneracy of the period of the judges. It was a bad time. But then we expand it and we begin to look more broadly. What other story does this remind you of? Where has this happened before? Yeah, in Genesis 19. Okay, and what happened there? Right, and then what happened? Yeah, the angelic visitors were able to strike the men of the city blind. Now that speaks volumes about the condition of Israel in the period of the judges. Even Sodom, you know, the proverbial bad city, wicked city, came off a bit better than Gibeah. Disaster was looming, but was averted by a divine action as God prevented this thing from happening. Didn't happen in Gibeah. Didn't prevent it this time. So low has Israel sunk at this period of time. And so when we begin to explore that is sometimes called narrative analogy, narratives that are in some sense analogous, it begins to enlighten us as to what the full significance of a particular passage may be. Well, we've been talking about how to interpret the historical books, and we want to continue and finish this outline at this juncture. We talked first about some preliminary questions related to the historical books. What is to be found in them? What kinds of things are we to learn from them? And then we began talking about basic exegetical steps that we should take in studying the historical books of the Old Testament. We talked about the necessity of getting first things first, submitting the mind and the heart to God. We gave some pointers about choosing a passage, about establishing the text by the comparison of different translations to come to some determination as to what the text is that we should be reading, what the original readings were. And then we began to talk about reading the text literarily, and we spent a good bit of time going through different types of approaches or different exegetical methods that are all involved in reading the text literarily. They're on the outline. I won't go over those again. But now we want to talk about two other steps in the exegetical process. One is to reflect on the text historically, because we are talking about reading the historical books. And it is important that we acknowledge that these are historical books that make historical truth claims. You see on your outline that I distinguish between truth claims and truth value. Let me explain what I mean by that, and you'll get more of this when you have the privilege, under my requirement of reading the Art of Biblical History, you'll learn more about truth claims and truth value. But let me explain it this way. Imagine with me that your mother or your father comes to you and begins to tell you something or to describe something or to communicate with you in some way. Now, you know your mother or father to be completely truthful. They've never lied to you. You trust them implicitly. And so you acknowledge the truth value of what they are saying. You know that what they're saying is true. However, that does not guarantee that you understand them. In other words, you may not understand what kinds of truth claims they are making. If they launch right into a story, you might not know if this is to be understood as a true story of something that actually happened, or is it a made-up story to illustrate a point, kind of like a parable. The truth claims are something that you may not know. You may have to listen carefully until you arrive at a determination as to exactly what your mother or your father is trying to communicate. Now, that in no way means that you question the truth value of what they say once you understand it. And I think sometimes in our debates over the Bible, sometimes we get confused on that particular issue, and we argue among ourselves, and we conflate this notion of truth claim and truth value, and we say things to each other like, well, if you don't believe that the text means this, then you just don't believe the Bible. Well, the other person may simply understand the text differently. Now, I'm not saying that everyone's understanding is equally valid, and this is not a way of adjudicating between different viewpoints, but it's a matter of discussion. And you can embrace the other individual metaphorically and say, yeah, I believe that you believe the Bible. I just think you're reading it wrong. So let's discuss. We agree on the truth value. Let's discuss the truth claims. Now, when we're reading these historical books, we need to be careful as we emphasize the literary crafting and the literary character of the books. We need to be very careful that our literary approach does not cause us to forget about or to underestimate or to dispense with the historical truth claims of the text. We read them trying to discover if they make certain claims about actual events that happened in history. And my contention would be that in the historical books of the Old Testament, that's what we have. Now, you may think that's a terribly obvious point to be making, but there are many biblical scholars nowadays that would not say that. They say, well, these are just pious stories meant to teach us theological lessons, but the stories you find in the book of Joshua are not at all to be considered historical accounts. Well, I would say the burden of proof is on them to demonstrate that they are not to be regarded as telling a true story, a story of something that actually happened, making allowances for the manner of the telling, the crafting of the story. So when we read historical books, we need to read them historically. We need to reflect on the text historically, not just literarily. The literary reading is the window. It helps us understand what the truth claims are. So it's very important. You can't just kind of dispense with the literary reading. You have to read it honestly as a literary work, and that will establish then the truth claims of the text. And then you want to assess the truth value. And you probably are saying to yourself, well, I thought we just accepted the truth value of the text. Well, if we are those who place our faith in the Bible as God's Word, then we do accept on faith, and we believe with good evidence, the truth value of the Bible. However, it's still useful to assess it for two reasons. One reason is that there is a certain apologetic value in trying to demonstrate the truth value of the truth claims made in the text. In other words, we're never going to prove the Bible to those who have not been given the eyes of faith, but we can at least press them if they are making claims that are not well-founded and claims that are actually unfair to the evidence. We'll have occasion later to talk about the emergence of Israel in Canaan. There's a lot of debate as to whether Israel entered Canaan by a conquest or by one of these other modes. You've read about it, and we'll talk about it, not tonight, but next time. There is value in then trying to establish some cross-references between the biblical stories and what we can discover archaeologically or whatever, because it does demonstrate the reasonableness of a particular kind of reading of the Bible. There's another reason that it is useful to seek to assess the truth value of a text, and that is that as believers, sometimes by looking at the evidence, extra-biblical evidence and so forth, it may alert us to the fact that we have, in fact, been misreading a text. You know, if something doesn't jive, then we have to ask ourselves, are we misinterpreting the extra-biblical data, which is always a live option, or are we misinterpreting the biblical data? And so it may serve as a corrective to our own interpretation. I'm not sure Christians ever did this, although they're always cited as doing it, believing that the earth was square because the Bible talked about the four corners of the earth. I think that that is probably not the case, and I think there are books, at least I know of one book, that seeks to argue that really Christians never believed that. But one can imagine that Christians possibly could have read the Bible in that way, or read that believe that the sun actually moved because the Bible talks about the rising and the setting of the sun, or the sun like a bridegroom coming out of its chamber. It certainly seems like movement, that kind of description. Well, learning a little bit about the solar system can be a corrective so that we read that as phenomenological language. What appears to happen, and people are describing what appears to happen in the natural world. They're not making a scientific statement about the sun actually moving and the earth standing still. Okay, so we can improve sometimes our interpretation by assessing the truth claims that are made and seeing if they square, if they have truth value in terms of other things that we can learn. Now, one way we do this is, there are really two ways. And again, we'll get into this much more thoroughly when you read The Art of Biblical History, but if you think of a text as a witness, sort of a witness on the stand, one way you go about trying to establish the credibility of the witness, in other words, are the truth claims made by that witness to be believed? Do they enjoy a truth value to which we can give assent? Well, one way to do that is to check the internal consistency of the story. If it doesn't make sense, if it contradicts itself, then it's not likely to be credible. We probably shouldn't believe it if it's contradictory internally, or if it is contradictory with other evidence that is assured. And I need to emphasize that particular issue because when it comes to archaeology, for instance, those artifacts come out of the ground and require interpretation. Archaeologists or biblical scholars or someone must begin talking about those particular artifacts that have come out of the ground. And as they talk about them, they are interpreting them. So that's another question we have to ask, the question of external consistency. Once we establish that there is a given piece of data, does the witness, what we have in the Bible, square with that? All right, so when we're reading historical books, we not only read them literarily, we read them with an interest in their historical truth claims and the truth value of those claims, and then we want to respond to the text theologically. We want to ask questions such as, how did the text challenge and encourage its earliest hearers? this begins to move us in the direction of applying the text to ourselves. What did the text teach its original hearers about God, about His character, about His actions? Furthermore, what did it teach them about themselves as human beings? What did it teach them about their fallen condition as fallen creatures who are sinful? Dr. Chappell, in his book, Christ-Centered Preaching, and also in his homiletics classes, trains our students to look for the fallen condition focus, and there may be more than one, in a text. And that's very important, because as we discover the fallen condition focus in the text, we begin to build a bridge to our own fallen condition. And we begin to say, you know, I have that same kind of problem. So the way in which the text addressed those people way back then may be the same way that it can address us today. So we ask questions like, how does the text challenge or encourage us today? In what way is our situation analogous to their situation? What can we learn about God and about the human condition and about the way in which human beings and God relate one to another in a covenant relationship? What can we learn about that from the text? And then one further question we should ask, what is the redemptive message that the text conveys? And this is sometimes a bit of a struggle to discover. What is the redemptive message in this particular passage? Often you need to be careful to read, as we were talking about in the literary stage of the reading, you need to read in the light of the larger context. It's often very important to read the larger context in order to begin to answer that question, what is the redemptive message? It's not always easy from just a few isolated verses to answer that question. Again, to quote Dr. Chappell in close succession there, he says, context is also part of text. I think I mentioned that before when we were talking about the literary approach. So think of the context as the text. Now, obviously, the context of this passage is all the rest of this, and you can't read that at every sitting. It's a lifelong pursuit to become really familiar with the context. But that helps us to discover the redemptive focus. Dr. Chappell mentions also four kinds of questions or expectations that we can bring to bear in terms of trying to discover the redemptive emphasis of a text. He says, ask these kinds of questions. And there's not going to be an answer to each one of these in every passage. There may be an answer to one or perhaps two. One question you can ask is, how does this passage in some way predict or foreshadow the work of Christ? Now, you've got to be careful with that, because you don't want to become allegorical or overly mystical or anything like that. But in keeping with its context, historically and literarily, does this passage in some way foreshadow or predict the work of Christ, the redemptive work of Christ? Second question is, well, if I can't find an answer to that one exactly, how does it at least prepare for the work of Christ? Some passages may be rather depressing because the focus is almost entirely on the fallen condition of human beings. My wife is doing a women's Bible study. She speaks to the women in the church on Tuesday mornings in our church, and she rotates with two others, and they're doing Hosea right now. Well, she doesn't have, according to her report, she doesn't have the really good chapters in Hosea. They gave her a section of chapters that are just hammering Israel with their sin and how they have been unfaithful to God, just as Gomer was unfaithful to Hosea. It's just hammering that fallen condition focus. Well, that may be all that's there in the passage, but what is the redemptive emphasis there? The need for it. The way it prepares for it. Think of the book of Ecclesiastes. It talks about how meaningless life is under the sun. There's a recognition that God is there, but the writer says, what can we know about God? Very little. Well, that presses us to find the answer. Ecclesiastes poses the question, this is our predicament, and in causing us to ask the question, it prepares for the work of Christ. So every passage pushes us toward Christ in one way or another. I said there were four. The next is to ask the question, does this passage in some way reflect the work of Christ? And this would be a question more appropriate for New Testament passages. And the fourth is, does it in some way result from the work of Christ? Again, probably a question that would be more applicable to New Testament passages. So look for the redemptive focus in a text. and ask, does it predict or does it prepare for the work of Christ in some way? It's not reading Christ in where he doesn't belong. It's recognizing that the entire Bible, the Old Testament, is pressing forward to Christ as the fulfillment of all of that which God has promised in the Old Testament. So it's finding Christ where he does belong. Okay, well, that's all I have to say on that. Let me ask if there are any comments or questions, and we'll take a momentary break after that. Yes. The last one I said was, does the passage in some way result from the work of Christ? Any other comments or questions? Yes. Tell me your name. Kevin, yes? Right. Yeah, sure. Well, maybe archaeology or is geology okay? The question is, can I give an example of external evidence from archaeology was the question, but let's make it geology as well because that pops to mind most quickly. That would help us to understand a passage of Scripture. Well, here's an example in Joshua chapter 6. No, I'm sorry, in Joshua chapter 3 with the crossing of the Jordan. It says somewhere in here, let's see, verse 13. And as the priests who were carrying the ark of the Lord of all the earth, set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap. And then it goes on, verse 16, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan, while the water flowing down to the sea of the Arabah was completely cut off. Now, what's interesting about that is at this very vicinity, in recorded history, in recent history, in the last 500-600 years, there have been numerous instances where landslides, when I say numerous, I mean 2-3, something like that, but significant instances, where landslides have fallen into the Jordan, causing the waters to be dammed up and piled up, as it were, in a heap for not only hours, but sometimes days. Okay. Now, there's an example where the text is referring to a miracle that God has performed, a miracle of timing, and the mechanism we've seen repeated, but he used that mechanism at just the right time to bring the people across.